This time on Weather Brains, April 8th, 2006, looking at how people reacted to the announced severe weather threat.
Schools closing during midday, was that necessary?
If a school gets hit, you know, who's responsible?
We have gotten to a point where everything seems to be kind of a breaking news thing. Everything has a little bit of a hype to it.
Something new by forecasters at the Storm Prediction Center.
A record-breaking first ever SPC issuance of a high risk in day two.
Why is the high risk a bust?
Well, geez, I mean, let's be realistic here.
I'm a little bit against having a high risk on day two.
But I was rather incensed at the whining I heard of people thinking it was a bust. I guess I disagree with JB a little bit.
Plus, April 8th, 1998, we'll look back and draw some comparisons to 2006.
I see homes moved off their foundation. Look at that, right below us. That's a home moved off its foundation. I mean, the actual house has been moved off the foundation.
Hello, I'm David Black on behalf of the Weather Company from Birmingham, Alabama, and welcome to Weather Brains, the podcast that's all about weather, put together by, you guessed it, a bunch of weather geeks. And speaking of weather geeks, have we got a crew on for this podcast? James Spann, chief meteorologist with the ABC television affiliate in Birmingham. Hello, James.
Hey, David, I'm going to clean out my workspace here. J.B. Elliott came down to our office and worked that severe weather outbreak Friday night, and there's just crates of Pop-Tarts and Buffalo Rocks in here. I'm having to move out of my operating position, so I think I've got the microphone now.
Not a pretty sight.
Did I leave it cleared?
You drank all the Buffalo Rock and ate all the Pop-Tarts. You slept all the boxes out here in the can, so
man,
it's just cleaned up now.
Man,
I had to throw away the boxes.
He must have sucked down about 20 of these Buffalo Rocks and 10 boxes of Pop-Tarts here.
Well, that's what kept me going for 25 hours without sleep.
You guys deserved it for what you went through. Hello to J.B. Elliott, already with us, and hello to Jason Simpson of ABC 3340, and also Brian Peters, ABC 3340. Hello, Brian.
Good evening, David and the gang.
Everybody's doing okay. Everybody made it through April 8th, 2006, but tell you what, it was scary.
It was quite a day, kind of one of those long days of waiting and watching. You know, David, for our friends in Tennessee, they got cranking early in the day with those horrible supercell thunderstorms and tornadoes in the afternoon. And, you know, we kind of had to play the waiting and watching game, and really we didn't spring into action until a little after 8 o'clock the night of April 7th, and then we stayed on television from 8 o'clock p.m. until about 3:30 a.m. So I guess it was about, 7 hours or so of coverage.
And storms hit, tornadoes hit all around, including, it looks like, North Alabama. For folks who look at ABC 3340's website, the weather blog is a real treasure trove of weather information. And James, I believe you made a post on there about tornadoes touching down across North Alabama as determined by the National Weather Service.
Yeah, even though I got, you know, Brian Peters by the office and he helped me, we're trying to get a tally on just exactly how many Alabama tornadoes we've had. And after making an initial list, somebody pointed out that the Weather Service defined another tornado. So I think I've got 16 on there now. 16, 8 F1s and 8 F0s here. So pretty wild night.
But we were very fortunate that they were F0s and F1s, not
right.
F3s or above.
How did we get so lucky, so to speak, and not draw an F4 or an F5, guys?
Go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say, I think that's a question that's going to be really difficult to answer, not only for just a bunch of weather geeks, but, you know, for the nation's foremost storm researchers out toward Norman, Oklahoma. You know, you got Bluestein and all those guys. They're just now learning why tornadoes form and doing the research on that. So the difference between an F0 and F1 on our end, it's almost indistinguishable as to what a thunderstorm would do. But Brian's a big time expert. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, I don't know that I'm an expert, but I noticed the 18Z sounding from Birmingham, Shelby County Airport, had a 5 or 5.5 degree cap.
I think it was 5.5 C. Yeah.
Okay. I can't help but wonder if that cap compared to the Jackson cap, which was only like about 1.5 or 2 degrees, I can't help but wonder if the cap didn't almost create a protective dome over central and north Alabama, because those thunderstorms formed, as James just pointed out, formed early in the day. I mean, James, what time was it that that morning we saw that one thunderstorm that produced half-dollar size hail south of Memphis?
And yeah, I think it was early in the morning.
Just,
yeah,
that was
Was that the storm that produced the Gallatin, Tennessee tornado? Or I know it was a single supercell by itself for a long time, and then some other storms developed. So I'm not sure if that was the Gallatin.
That was the initial storm. I don't think that was the Gallatin one, though.
That first one moved up closer to it moved up to about 40 miles west of Nashville, I believe.
It was closer to Clarksville. Yeah.
And then when the thunderstorms began to develop again, that moved fairly smoothly over into northeast Mississippi, the very northwest corner of Alabama, down towards Jackson. And it just sat there for, let's see, I'm trying to think. I was out in the field there for like, 6 hours, it seemed like? The thunderstorms were moving northeast along that line, and the line was inching eastward, but I mean agonizingly slow. And then, about a little after the 10 o'clock news, it really began moving at that point, and by 2:30, 3 a.m., it was into the Birmingham area. So I wonder if the cap didn't have something to do with it. I don't know that it did. I'm just supposing here.
I'd like to see a mesoscale analysis and see if there are any, outflow boundaries or little fine lines or something. I think that had a lot to do with our big F5 here in 1998, and sometimes little mesoscale features can have something to do with it, too.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that has a lot to do with the fact that one synoptic setup, or when the word synoptic for somebody who's not a weather geek means like the weather on a large scale, like cold fronts, warm fronts, high pressure, low pressure, those large things that we track on a weather map. One synoptic setup is not going to give the exact same result as one that looks very similar to it. You can compare April 7th and 8th, 2006 to April 8th, 1998. The synoptic setups are very, very similar, but as you saw, very, very different result.
Well, and you and James both bring up a good point. We're looking at synoptic scale features, which we can identify quite well. It's those mesoscale features that James just mentioned that are extremely difficult to identify. And like during the April 8th, 1998 tornado, I was one of the ones on duty at the National Weather Service, and we did not identify that particular boundary that we saw intersect the thunderstorm and I think help to give it more oomph, more power, more whatever, more rotation, more vorticity, whatever you want to say, and produce the F5 tornado in western Jefferson County.
And we were sitting in the weather office at 3340, and we had just about written off that high-risk area, and it was late developing, and that lone thunderstorm developed over in east-central and northeast Mississippi as a small shower and became that F5.
But here's the big question, David, that everybody's been asking, and be interesting on this roundtable here. Was the high risk a bust, as defined by the Storm Prediction Center for Friday and Friday night, that include parts of Alabama and Tennessee? And you got a lot of angry people. The public seems to think that it was a bust, and within the weather community, it seems to be divided. Brian wrote a great piece on the blog about that.
And what about all of the? I'm going to use the word hysteria that I heard among some folks during the midday hours on Friday. Schools closing during midday, was that necessary? Any opinions?
Well, I'm pretty strongly opinionated on that. I think that schools don't need to close during threats like that. For one reason, in rural school systems, a large percentage of those school kids live in mobile homes. So you're sending them from the safest conceivable place, which is the school building, and you're sending them to a death trap, which is a mobile home. So in a way, I understand the school systems are concerned about the safety and they don't want kids on buses. I understand that they think they're doing the right thing, but sometimes I question that. And I don't know anybody that really thought it was going to get that active in the afternoon. All along, we kind of targeted Friday night.
You guys were saying overnight, 2 days in advance.
Yeah, and even the news department here, they came over and teased a story about, what went wrong with the forecast. Why did schools close and all this? And I went over there and said, what's the deal? And I would like to know why schools closed, but in my opinion, in that case, it wasn't necessary. But I do applaud the systems for thinking, safety for the kids. But in terms of the high risk, I don't know. David, there's a very specific definition, and Brian is a former Weather Service guy. He's more a definition guy than I am. I think it was a good high risk. And Brian, you're the technical definition of a high risk. I mean, how do they do in your opinion?
I wrote a piece on the blog because I was rather incensed at the whining I heard about the high risk and people thinking it was a bust. I mean, you overlay the high risk and the moderate risk on the storm reports that occurred, and it met the Storm Prediction Center's criteria, with possibly the exception that we didn't see more than two or three F3 and above tornadoes. And it's like, wow. I mean, you had at least one F3 in Nashville. It's like, okay, the criteria says two or more F3 plus. Well, geez, I mean, let's be realistic here. I mean, forecasting F3 and above, I mean, that's pretty tough right there. But to hit the area so closely, I just think it was brilliant. I mean, they didn't hype it. They were very realistic the day before. A record-breaking first ever SPC issuance of a high risk in day two. You know, and the whole point of getting information out is to make people aware of the risk. And I think that's exactly what they did. I mean, the fact that the schools were aware of that in the morning. Now, I stand with James Spann here because I think it's a mistake to let kids out because of the same reason that James did. Now, I applaud the schools for thinking about safety. And if this had been a winter storm situation, I wouldn't have any criticism at all. I wouldn't, you know, be throwing some darts here. But the fact that, as James points out, a lot of kids go home, they're home alone, whether it's a mobile home or an apartment or what, even a permanent structure. I mean, the kids are still home alone. And what we know now, what we know today is that people still don't have family plans. And so the kids are home, they don't really have any guidance. And I think that's wrong. And I don't know if this is being driven by a safety motive. I hope it is. But I'm also afraid it may be driven by a lawsuit risk, you know, by liability, because the kids, if a school gets hit, you know, who's responsible? And I don't know. I have mixed emotions about this, but I would certainly not recommend in those situations. I think, as James just said, I think 95 times out of 100, the kids are going to be much safer in a school building. And, of course, letting kids out in a bus at 3 o'clock, that's the biggest mistake that you can ever make, because you're putting kids on the road in a severe weather episode. In this case, we were not into a severe weather episode, but another side for the schools, we were in a tornado watch. So, I don't know. It's a tough one.
I think you have psychological issues here. First of all, you have, and those of us in the news media, we're guilty of this, because we have gotten to a point where everything seems to be kind of a breaking news thing. Everything has a little bit of a hype to it. And at 5 a.m. on Friday, I was basically force-fed April 8th, 1998 video and said, VO this or voice over this. And, you know, we were not necessarily for you. First of all, you can't forecast a mesoscale event like a thunderstorm 12 hours in advance. You know that there are going to be thunderstorms, but you can't forecast an F5 tornado 12 hours in advance. We know that. I don't think that the general public knows that well enough. So there's this psychological problem we have where we're putting this video on television and we're showing people images of what an F5 tornado did 8 years ago to the day, and there's this high risk in the same area. But just like I said earlier, the one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that unlike chemistry, unlike physics, meteorology is a young science. It's only been around since the 40s and 50s in a real solid form here in the United States. You know, of course, weather records go back a long way, but as far as real hard science goes, real research, you don't go back all that far. So we haven't figured out all of our Madame Curies haven't come around and found radioactive elements. You know, we haven't had these physicists, you know, from the 1600s and 1700s. We haven't had that. So we don't have that same grasp on the science of meteorology that some of the physicists or chemists or biologists have on their brand of science. So I don't think the public understands that, and I think there's a big misconception there. So there's psychological problem number one. And then problem number two is that people perceive a high risk, no matter what it is, as death and destruction. I really believe that. And I don't know, is there something that we can do better as communicators to try to communicate the fact that it's a risk and that there's some sort of probability to it, and then go back to that issue of not being a 100% rock-solid science, especially on the microscale and mesoscale. So I don't know that.
And I'm afraid probably a lot of people don't give that kind of thought to an immediate situation such as what you're talking about, Jason, where people are seeing the video of what happened here 8 years ago to the day, or just about to the day, and at the same time, just seconds later, they're hearing about a high risk forecast 2 days in advance by the Storm Prediction Center.
Exactly. To them, 2 + 2 = 4.
Exactly.
And in this case, to us, it's 2 + x = y. Right. There are unknowns there that we can't solve for.
I don't know what JB thinks about this.
I'm a little bit against having a high risk on day two. I think it's unwise because so much can change, and you have to change the area and maybe change it back to moderate. But I do say, you know, in the statements that the Storm Prediction Center explains it, that they could say there may be a significant risk tomorrow, but I'd hate to put a high risk on it 24 hours in advance.
But if you change it, are you not going to be accused of flip-flopping too?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. If you say a significant risk tomorrow, that is broad-based enough to where it wouldn't mean necessarily high. It could mean moderate too.
So yeah, I guess I disagree with JB a little bit, because I think the high risk on day two was in this case a good move, because it did. I think it did pan out. I don't think it was a bust, and I think it did contribute to maybe increased awareness. And I think increased awareness is important. I would hope that SPC would not start doing high risks on day two real frequently. I mean, because we all agree, I think, that on Thursday it really did look like there was going to be some significant weather. You know, and you could argue, as I think JB is, that, you know, a moderate risk on from day two, on the day two outlook would have been okay. But I do think the high risk probably stimulated interest and awareness.
I'm assuming we're probably going to be seeing more of that in the future.
Well, if their confidence is as high as they must have been or felt they were on Thursday to go high risk, let me tell you, folks, I'm absolutely positive there was probably some very interesting discussion going on in SPC, since this was the first time they've ever done this. You can imagine, if you were a fly on the wall, you probably had those guys bantering back and forth for, I would say, a couple hours, probably. I mean, because I would consider them very knowledgeable. I hate to call anybody a complete expert in the field of meteorology, because, as Jason pointed out, and I agree with him, there's so many small-scale features that you cannot forecast more than a few hours in advance. I mean, even on April the 8th, 1998, 8 years ago, you know, we really didn't recognize that boundary that we later saw and thought was extremely obvious on the radar images. In real time, we really didn't recognize that. Now, we did recognize the boundary between the cloud cover and the sunny, you know, the clear skies, or reasonably clear skies, but we didn't really recognize that boundary that moved from the convection that occurred across the south and southeast part of the state in the morning. We didn't really recognize that boundary as it was happening. We recognized it in studying and looking back at data after the fact. And I think that boundary contributed, as a lot of research out of Norman and other places has proven, that when you have that kind of boundary, you have a much higher risk of creating a major tornado. And I know in doing the aerial survey, and I did two aerial surveys, one with the state police and one with Civil Air Patrol, that the tornado began as an F0. I mean, we're talking about 10% of the trees knocked down in Tuscaloosa County. And then it crosses the Jefferson County line, and, you know, it increases a little bit, maybe 15, 20% of the trees. And then all of a sudden, this narrow path, maybe 100 yards wide, becomes a half a mile. Well, I'm pretty sure that's where it intersected with that boundary that you see on radar, and that's where something happened to intensify that rotation and produce a monster of a tornado that kills 32 people in about a 45, 50-minute period of time.
And that's one that we will never forget. In fact, let's go back to that time in 1998 when Alabama faced this ferocious tornado.
Let's go back to the radar. We have, I understand, confirmed damage out here. But again, I can't tell you enough to take this thing seriously. So if you live in Pleasant Grove, Hueytown, Mulga, Inslee, Fairfield, Bessemer, Lipscomb, any of these communities out here in the western part of Jefferson County, go to a safe place immediately.
At the same time, amateur radio operators were closely monitoring conditions across West Jefferson County and relaying their reports live to the National Weather Service.
34 CUE, 34 QDO. 34 CUE, go. Yeah, that's bar in like 65 northbound and dime 5. on that tail. I just passed the Fulton Dale exit.
Roger that. Appreciate that report. W4CUE.
Hey, 4LMU.
W4CUE, go with your report, sir.
Yes, I just passed the forest tail and took 3/4 inch to 1 inch size hail.
Roger, appreciate that report. W4CUE.
Jim, I've got had a touchdown just about 2 minutes ago in Edgewater. You got that? WA4 Uniform Hotel Charlie.
Okay, copy, touchdown in Edgewater about 2 minutes ago, is that correct?
This is correct. It is. Yeah, that's a roger, Jim. That's a roger. We got several roofs blown off, trees down, power lines down. Gonna need police and fire, possibly some ambulances. I've just now been able to get out the door to assess the damage, roger.
Roger that, Mark. Be careful out there. We copied the report, touchdown in Edgewater 2 minutes ago, roofs off. Power line damage, gonna need police and ambulance.
Thank you, Jim. WA4UHC, clear and QRT.
Now, because this was a night tornado, most folks didn't know how extensive the damage was until the next day. April 9th, James takes a tour aboard Airlink 3340, giving the world its first look at what really happened.
Let's take you down to the ground from Airlink 3340. We'll show you some of the damage. John, can you get a shot of that fire department? That's a volunteer fire department. The building's gone. The fire trucks are still in there. I mean, the building is gone. We're basically over Birmingport Road, Alabama Highway 269, but that's just an amazing sight. And even close to the tornado damage path, I see shingles off. I see homes moved off their foundation. Look at that, right below us. That's a home moved off its foundation. I mean, the actual house has been moved off the foundation by probably 50 yards down there. See that house right there? You can see the foundation on the other side of that. But some of these were well-built structures. Some of these structures were probably not anchored very well, but some of these were brick homes that were well-built. And the only way people could have survived is if they got down in that low spot, lowest floor, away from windows, everything we talk about. But quite frankly, and I'll say this, we don't say this often, but in an F4 and F5 tornado, sometimes there's nothing you can do. Down below, you can see homes reduced to rubble. We are specifically now in the Rock Creek area. This is about 3 miles or so east of Oak Grove School that was destroyed. The damage just started in this area. Again, we're in Rock Creek, close to Oak Grove. And from here, almost due east, the damage extended right on through such communities as Edgewater, Sylvan Springs, Pratt City, on out to the Birmingport Highway or Alabama Highway 269. Down below, we've seen cars in the woods. We've seen boats in the middle of nowhere. We've seen homes where, quite frankly, we don't know where they came from. And, John, if you could show that damage over in the valley down here in that ravine, we do understand that one of the fatalities came from that particular structure. That was a mobile home that was blown off its foundation into that ravine. We understand at least one person died in that area. And again, that's in the Rock Creek community. And again, look down below. You can see a vehicle in a lake down there. It looks like that's a truck blown into the lake. You can see the roof off that house. And that house is not where it used to sit. The house you see there on television used to sit about 200 yards away from there. Back on the foundation. That's the actual foundation where the house used to sit. And again, we just see down below people walking. They're stunned, they're dazed. Many people are thankful to be alive. In fact, everyone we talked to down there, they said, we're just glad that God spared our life. We can rebuild these homes, but we're just glad to be alive.
Bring back some memories, James.
Yeah, you know, that was just like almost surreal. We worked that outbreak the night before. And really, you know, when I went to sleep for a couple of hours, about 2 o'clock in the morning, we had no idea how many people died, what it looked like out there. You never know until the first light of day. And the news director said, we want you to go fly in the helicopter since you're familiar with the territory. So I slept for about an hour at best. And about 5 o'clock, 5:30, we got up in the helicopter and we first hit that Oak Grove High School, and you just could hear everybody's jaw drop in our newsroom and around the state and around the whole country. And flying through that, I could still see people waving, you know, red rags, letting us know that they needed help, and we could just assume that somebody was watching, that they could send help out there. It was just absolutely surreal.
Brian, you and I were out there a few days afterward with a disaster team, and I tell you what, it's an emotional experience to be up close and see that kind of destruction and what it does to people.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was I had a very bad opinion of James Spann.
Great.
The morning after, because I did, of course, working for the National Weather Service, did not have access to a helicopter, and I called one of the captains in the aviation unit, and he told me who to get in touch with the state troopers, the Alabama state troopers, and they were very, very generous. They had the governor standing by to fly, but Fob James was the governor at that time, and he really didn't like flying. And so I was given an escort out there, because what James did is he got up there early, and that's one of the things you have to do if you're going to do a storm survey. And of course, with a tornado of that magnitude, not only ABC 3340, but every media outlet you can think of, from newspapers to every radio station to every television station, they're calling the Weather Service. Well, was it this? Was it that? And it's kind of like, well, you know, we can't know till we get up there. But fortunately, with the help of the state troopers, I was able to fly over a good deal of the damage and was able to classify the tornado relatively quickly as an F5. But then, David, were you with me when we went with...
I was with you when Tim Marshall, engineer, was there, and that was an absolutely fascinating experience, first to see the destruction, but then to get an expert like him explaining what was actually happening.
See, you were in awe. I was scared to death, because to have somebody of the magnitude of a Tim Marshall to come in and look at the damage after I'd made a classification of an F5, and I was scared that, you know, I was wrong. to have somebody of his caliber to come in, but as you remember,
he backed you up.
We were going through, and Tim said, "No, don't have a bit of a problem with an F5. I mean, after all, 32 people died, and you know, of course, there is no death toll requirement for an F5. It's all related to the structural damage, but there were definitely pockets of F5 damage." In those areas that James was describing, where the houses were off their foundations, and some of those were well-built homes, some were not. Some were, you know, less well-built homes, frame homes that were not anchored to their foundation. And that's one of the things you have to know if you're going to go make a classification of a tornado path, is you have to know something about the structures, what they were before they were destroyed. I was not absolutely comfortable at that point, knowing that the expert that Tim Marshall is and what he knows, and I've taken a good deal of training with him, and he is absolutely marvelous. He trains very well. He really understands how the wind interacts with buildings and how buildings come apart. He was on the survey team with the Piedmont tornado, and in that tornado, Tim described to me how he thought the building at the Goshen United Methodist Church came apart, and when I was able to see the videotape taken within that church, the church came apart exactly as he had described it to me a couple of weeks earlier. And the videotape does not show what a lot of people thought it did. It doesn't really show people being killed, because the videotape or the camera was taken out by a cement block or a brick before the roof actually came down. You see the roof beginning to lift, but before you see anything more, the camera is taken out by some sort of flying debris. We think a cement block or a brick.
And speaking of the April 8th, 98 tornado, guys, we got email from a WeatherBrains listener, John, in the Concord, Hueytown area. He asks, quote, "What were the conditions on April 8th, 1998? What triggering mechanism did we have? I remember the day all too well. At the same time, I don't remember what all the factors that came into play were. I was a weather buff in that time, but having gone through all the chaos and aftermath, it made me become an even bigger one today." He goes on to say, quote, "I was at work at a grocery store down the road from where I live, and my shift ended at 4:30 p.m., I was walking out of the door when my manager, who lived in Rock Creek, stopped me and strongly cautioned me that he knew the feeling in the air that it was going to be a very bad evening and that it would not surprise him for us to have a tornado hit. I was headed for church in Oak Grove. I thought it was so strange for him to have nailed it, however. He was a big-time fisherman and had been through enough storms similar to know what he was talking about, not to have been a meteorologist. Thanks for your help, and if you have time to do a discussion on this, I would greatly appreciate it. Guys, you do such a magnificent job in every aspect of your jobs. I hear people complimenting you all at the ballpark and grocery store when I'm there. And James, there's a whole heck of a lot of people who are so grateful and thankful for you having the guts to start the wall-to-wall coverage when you got to ABC 3340. You and the rest of you are loved more and more every day. It's a shame that it took not only the April 8th disaster, but some of the others as well, to finally start and take you serious, but they do now. Again, that's from John in Concord, Hueytown. Any thoughts on that, guys?
Ahead, well, that's a very kind note. And I will say this. I think that night defined our little television station back then. We were the only station, you know, doing this aggressive, severe weather coverage. Now everybody does. And hey, that's great. I'm glad the other guys do. But that was quite a night for us. And I remember sitting around the weather office that day, basically like what we did last Friday. Everybody was kind of debating. We were waiting and watching. And, you know, some of us were thinking, this is no big deal. And some of us were thinking, this could be a big deal. And like we talked about before, David, the synoptic setup, as I remember, was not all that different from what we had this past Friday. The difference was the mesoscale, the small-scale stuff that you don't know until it's happening, and sometimes you don't know until after it's over. And like Brian said, I didn't notice that fine line until you go back and look at the radar charts after the whole thing was over. It's hard doing analysis on the fly. So it all boiled down to the mesoscale. It was a small little boundary that came through here, and that thing went from an F0 to an F5 in no time at all. So it was all about the mesoscale, and that's stuff you don't know until right before it happens. But Brian pulled the trigger on the warning, and he ought to get the credit for Brian, what was the lead time on that?
I believe it was on the order of 12 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, look, you got 15 minutes to get out of there, and I think the warning was excellent, and thank goodness it was a Wednesday night. It was in prime time. A lot of people saw it, but even with good warning and good response, you still had 32 lives. But if Brian didn't pull the trigger, instead of, 32 lost lives, how many are you talking then? 50, 100? I don't know. So I think the warning process worked pretty good that night, and we had a high risk, and there was a tornado watch. Everything was in place, so the whole system worked about as good as it's going to work.
Well, James is being very generous with his credit. Actually, there were three or four of us on duty at the Weather Service, so I was just one of that group, and I was in the forefront doing the storm survey the next day, trying to get that done and give people up. I'm just like James was. I got a little more sleep than he did that night, but after working all day from the morning doing an interview with the Wall Street Journal reporter to working until 10:30 or 11, I managed to go home knowing I was going to have to do a survey the next morning. But when I went home, we were sure there was one person that had been killed. When I got up in the morning, the first thing I did was to rush out in my bathrobe and grab the newspaper. And the newspaper had headlines, as I recall, and my memory may be fading here, but as I recall, the newspaper was headlined 13 dead. And less than an hour later, I was at the Weather Service office, and the death toll was around 30. And, of course, the final number was 32 in that storm. In that tornado, two more in the same storm, but another tornado in St. Clair County with that same supercell. It's one of those events, as James said, a defining moment, and it's one that you will never, never, ever forget, especially when you're out there in the damage, as David found out going out there and seeing it. I mean, the television stations do a fabulous job of presenting it, but when you're standing in the middle of it, the overwhelming power that had to be there to cause that kind of destruction, it really doesn't come through the pictures as well as it does a personal visit.
And it burns images in your mind, in my case, forever. I'll have them with me forever.
Yes. I think the fellow who said it just felt bad, one of the things meteorologists look for are high dew points, which represents the amount of low-level moisture, because by converting moisture into water vapor, the moisture, the humidity that we have, and turning that into clouds releases heat. And that release of heat helps to increase the strength of updrafts in thunderstorms. And then, as James and Jason have both mentioned in this podcast, this episode, you have to have some other mesoscale features. And, of course, we're finding more and more that there is some sort of boundary often associated with these violent tornadoes. And those are the things that you don't know to the last minute. And I think James and I share this, that, you know, in the real time, we just simply did not notice that fine line on radar. It was so obvious a couple of days later when you're looking at time lapse. But when you're under the gun and you're looking at storm structure, those things, those little features just sort of slip by. I mean, it's not negligence. It's not, you know, a poor job. It's just those fine things are overwhelmed by the what we often called in the Weather Service the mother of all hooks. That hook was just absolutely spectacular, and many Weather Service offices still use that hook as an excellent example of how a hook looks on the WSR 88D or the NEXRAD.
And the thing that I remember, David, was the debris in the hook. I mean, you had this big debris echo in there from, you know, stuff. Yes. in the vortex, like, you know, cars in the air and pieces of houses and boards and bricks and glass and nails, that shrapnel reflecting, you know, the radar beam reflecting off that. So it was just it was one of those wild nights.
Sounds like something out of a movie, but it's real.
Yep.
Another email from another listener, John in Athens, Georgia, guys. Hello, it's John Knox, the other Huffman High alum, meteorologist, and member of the James Spann and J.B. Elliott fan clubs.
Woohoo!
Wanted to write and say that my wife, a climatologist, and I just listened to the April 3rd, 1974 super outbreak recreation on Weather Brains, and it's great. Especially good to hear J.B. participate. It makes the recreation very real. His story about sending the thunderstorm at the rude old woman is classic. Congratulations on a great job of writing, Bill. On that night in Birmingham, I was in my family's quasi-permanent tornado shelter, a ping pong table in the southwest corner, yes, really, of our basement. My brother and I slept all night under the ping pong table, the only time in my life I've done an all-nighter in a shelter.
I've never slept under a ping pong table, but I've never slept in the basement, but I've gone to the basement a number of times.
Guess you got to do what you got to do.
That's better than nothing.
Yeah. By the way, the National Weather Service, when they put in the Doppler radar system and actually built a number of buildings, actually built a storm shelter as far as I know, any building the Weather Service built, they included a storm shelter for the employees in the middle of the structure. And it was a steel-reinforced concrete vault with a door that I was told, this is hearsay, but I was told the door would withstand small arms fire, and that was a rating according to the FBI. So I hope small arms fire equals what a tornado can throw at you.
I want to ask you one quick thing, James. Tell me about the television ratings from this past April 7th and 8th. It sounds as if lots of folks were tuning in ABC 3340.
Well, and we don't, you know, share these numbers to really brag on what we do, but I think it's to show the public hunger for this kind of, you know, information. Our coverage was on from like 8 o'clock until 3:30, and the ratings peaked at 1:30 a.m. That's 90 minutes after midnight, and our station did a 19.5 rating and a 43 share. Let me tell you what, you don't get those kind of numbers for some big hot shot, you know, primetime show, much less something at 1:30 a.m. when normally you got Ginzu knife infomercials and Pocket Fisherman infomercials on the air. So that is astounding to me that we can generate those numbers. And again, what that shows is that people are genuinely wanting weather information when the weather's bad. So again, for all the other meteorologists that listen to this at television stations, hint, hint, you know, aggressive long-form coverage, yet you're going to get a few nasty emails every time. Just get used to it. That's just part of living. But, you know, are you going to, deal with, you know, 5 or 10 people that send you hate letters? Or are you going to give, you know, 1 million people what they want? So the numbers were just astounding.
And I know you guys will be there the next time it happens, whenever it does happen.
Yep, we'll be there. And, you know, the other thing, David, that's really changed is the streaming stuff online. Anybody can watch it anywhere in the world. Had an email from Germany. Somebody was watching us there, and just a lot of my friends around the country. And of course, anybody with relatives here, they can watch. So I think that's been a great new dimension we've added this year is the streaming video, too.
And I use that, too, James. It's a nice feature to have.
A reminder that the opinions expressed on Weather Brains are strictly those of the speaker and are not necessarily those of ABC 3340. If you would like to contact us, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. For James Spann, J.B. Elliott, Jason Simpson, and Brian Peters, I'm David Black. We thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Bye.